So what her agenda actually unfolds into. I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck to you.
And I appreciate being on, and I look forward to talking to you again, because right now it's a big question mark what's really actually going to happen with her government.
Thank you. My guest has been Michael Leonardi, joining me from Italy. He's an educator, an activist, and a contributor to Counterpunch. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out, so make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I am your host, Ramses Ja. Big shout out to Q Ward, who has taken the week off to do a bit of recovering. I won't put his business out there, but everything is good in Q land, and we look forward to a speedy and safe return of him to the show very soon. This week, we have a lot for you to stick around for, not the least of which is a gentleman who is joining us now. He is someone that I met at a city council meeting. We're electing a new city council person in my district where I live. And he just had some really important things that he brought up in the debate, I guess it would be called. And I thought of inviting him up on the show to talk to us today about, you know, some of his policies and some of the things that I think we need to discuss in this forum here. He has led a $1 billion+ in technology and transformational initiatives. He's also been an advisor to many of this country's most successful corporations. And of course, again, he's now running for city council in District 6 in Phoenix. We have Harry Curtin with us today. Thank you for joining
Thank
us.
You. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, sir. And then, of course, we have a lot more to stick around for as well. We are going to be discussing Benjamin Banneker for our Way Black History Fact. We're also going to be talking about how you can become a better ally. There is a lot going on with Alabama and the way that their district lines are drawn for voting. A lot of folks feel like they are trying to weaken the black vote, and there's a lot of eyes on that, and there are a lot of national implications for that. So we're going to break that down for you as well. So that, and of course, plenty more to stick around for on today's episode of Civic Cypher. But first and foremost, like we always do right around now, I'd like to start us off with some Ebony Excellence. So this week's Ebony Excellence is sponsored by Let's Keep Growing Hair Care Products. They make organic hair care and growth products, which are available through Walmart and, of course, letskeepgrowing.com. And I'd like to take this week's Ebony Excellence. Normally, I pull a story from somewhere really cool and I share it with you, but this one is a little bit more personal. It's a little closer to home. A gentleman I know by the name of Iron Daniels, a.k.a. Rockadala, and I want to shout him out because he recently released a feature film. It's called The Unhitched King, and he is an example of a person who came up through adversity and has a, we'll call it a street-level story. but over the past several years, he's focused on his passion for filmmaking. And the most recent result of his efforts is called The Unhitched King. So it's really special to see someone start from where he started and now has a film in movie theaters that you and I can go and see. Again, it's the culmination of a years-long effort, and it's a comedy. It's hilarious and inspirational. And of course, he's an example of exactly what a person can do with their life, despite the many challenges of their youth, to rise above and become a master of their craft and ultimately make a national splash. I'm very proud of Iron Daniels. We all are. We know him as IROC. We know him as Rockadalo. He has many names in where I live. But now that he's on a national scene, we have to call him Iron Daniels. So we will do just that. But again, we're very proud of him, and we implore you to go check out his movie. I'm sure you'll love it. And if you can't make it to a theater near you that's carrying the film, bear in mind that it will be making its way to streaming platforms nationwide after its theatrical run. So that for this week is a more personalized Ebony Excellence. And once again, shout out to our sponsor, Let's Keep Growing Hair Care. Again, letskeepgrowing.com. Now, Harry Curtin is with us today.
Glad to be here.
Yes, sir. So let me tell a little bit more about the story.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So I was invited to the meeting. We have a current city council person in my district, and he has termed, meaning that he cannot run again because of term limits.
Yep.
And so I believe there were six people on a stage. I was invited to this event by one of my neighbors, yep, who knew I was politically active, and of course that I host this show.
Yeah, absolutely.
And her name is Nikki, so shout out to Nikki. She's a listener of the show as well. She invited me here. I'd never been to something like this. And of course I'm sitting and I'm listening to everyone. And I very early on realized that I was one of two Black people in the room, one of whom was on the stage.
Yeah.
But the only one from the community sitting there and listening for, obviously there are things that affect our community, but there are other things that affect Black people specifically that, and brown people,
yeah,
and they don't affect other folks. And so I was listening with that ear, because a lot of times, and as I could see, those ears weren't present in that room. Those mm-hmm. questions could not be asked no. with any authenticity mm-hmm. because there would not be any lived experience underneath systemic or oppressive systems or whatever, invisible or otherwise.
Sure.
And so listening to this panel of six people who all are very eloquent, very well-versed, understand sort of what the needs of the city are, one person stood out to me as being empathetic and really addressing things on a human level. There was a person who was really technically like, you know, we're going to get business and business is going to do great. Mm-hmm. And that's all well and good. And there's another person, we need to be safe, and you know, we need to, our first responders. And of course, that's all well and good. Other folks mm-hmm. were, you know, about water, and other folks, you know, they have everyone, teachers, all of these things are necessary. We're human yeah. beings. This is the way our society works. This is how we grow and prosper and thrive as a society. But I think that the thing that stood out to me was the individual I found myself listening to had more to say about how individual human beings are affected by different things and how experiences might be different. And when we start there, we can develop policy that has a real impact and really feels like it resonates with folks. And that person, of course, was you.
I appreciate that.
Yes, sir.
Speaking from my heart, that's for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So yeah. That's yeah. how I got to meet you, but I don't yeah. know your story, and our listeners, of course, don't know your yeah. story. Let's talk a little bit about your background, sort of what led you to.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I think just to kind of get on top of that, I think for me, it's a revolution of being human, you know, getting back to the truth. And I think we just get farther and farther from the truth in politics, and one of the reasons why I wanted to run. But you know, it's always important. I like to tell my story and why am I doing this? You know,
please,
it's just such an odd thing to run. Everyone's afraid of it right now, and they have good reason to be. For me, it's really been a long story. I mean, for probably 10 years, I've been thinking about it.
Okay.
Like how, you know, and I've gone through an evolution of that process and thinking about it.
Sure.
You know, I think 10 years ago, I thought, well, that's what you do. You go run for office. And then as I grew up more and more, I realized, well, I think I just want to help people. Mm-hmm. And in business, I found that the things I love the most, you know, you mentioned some of the things I've done, and I've really been instrumental in really large scale projects, sure, and things that have really made a difference. Some billions of dollars of loans for people that couldn't get loans before. There's all sorts of areas I've worked that have been really special to me and powerful, but sometimes it feels like I'm just making a lot of people money, mm-hmm, and I haven't really gotten to the root of helping people the way I want.
Okay.
But that took me years, you know, to kind of go through this process. And eventually I got to, okay, well, the city council position, you know, legislature can be really noisy. There's a lot of members, but in your city council, there's a small group of members making big decisions. In Phoenix, you've got, you know, $1.6 billion budget plus that are decided by 8 people plus the mayor. That's your city. You know, that's police, fire, that's streets. This is what you see every day. Right. And so I said, well, that's something I could maybe get my handle on. You know, I've got a grip on that. I can work with the people, with a small group of people, and get some things done. I see it. You know, I see a connection. I think I also saw that Phoenix isn't too far gone. You know, I think some cities are so old. I grew up in Buffalo, New York. It's so bureaucratic. It's so slow.
Sure.
I don't know if I can fix anything there, you know, yeah, but this is still a young city. We have good infrastructure. We did things right from the beginning, but we're just starting to slip. It's like everything's getting slower and more bureaucratic and more about politics and decisions.
Okay.
And every city does that. What about if we're not that way?
Mm.
You know? So that's part of the reason I came here. But one of the cores for me too was not only my kind of business, I think, experience and knowing that I could solve big problems, mm, was growing up as a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up, it was hard for me. I grew up, my mom was severely mentally ill. She's still institutionalized right now, been in and out of institutions my whole life, bipolar, manic depressive, very intelligent woman, very capable, but this disease has really overtaken her. And my father, very nice man, but severe alcoholic, and always brought us really financial burden because of that, you know, power going out, a lot of government cheese. Mm-hmm. You know, I lost my sister in the mid 80s, my oldest sister, through a terrible rape and murder that ended up being national news. The guy ended up going on the road, and we had police protecting our home. Mm. And it was really intense. And I really ran out of there as soon as I could. I got on a motorcycle when I was 18. I ran, mm-hmm, for the West Coast because it was as far as I could go from, yeah, all these memories, yeah, and really started to pick myself up and work and get a job, get two jobs, get three jobs, and then start to just forget about that past. And I think now I'm at a point in my life, I've got some skills. Well, I don't want kids to go through what I went through.
Okay.
So maybe I can put those skills to work.
Sure.
You know, so.
Sure. No, I love that. And I think it's important that people listen to stories like this. Obviously, you know, we're listening to around the country.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact that you said, you know, this is a place where I feel like I can make some changes. I can, you know, make a splash, make an impact. And are doing just that. I think that's something that a lot of people can relate to, especially after the past couple of years. There's been a growing divide ideologically, politically, yeah, in terms of morals and values and things like this. I remember, I'm 40 years old now, so I, yeah, remember once upon a time that for the most part, everyone kind of was pointed at the same outcomes, hoping for the same outcomes,
yeah,
just had different paths of, yeah, getting, yeah, there.
I know what connected my speech now when you say that point.
Sure, sure, exactly.
We'll get to
now,
it.
Sure. Now, yeah, it feels as like we can't even agree on what a shared reality is.
Yes.
It's like one of us is subscribing to a vivid and tactile reality.
Totally.
And the other group is imagining their world as a separate independent thing that,
yeah,
you know, it's a little weird. And so
no, I think politicians are dividing us, not bringing us together.
Yeah,
this,
yeah,
is the reason I'm really doing this. Mm-hmm. I just think it's broken, you know. Sure. They don't have to. When I get down to it, man, I got friends that are Republicans, Democrats, on far sides.
Mm-hmm.
If you just talk as people,
you find agree, a lot,
man,
more.
Yeah, yeah, you want the same, sure, things. You want safety in schools. You want all these things we want, but we politicians continue to just rip us apart.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not right. Yeah. And it's a main reason I'm driving at this and trying to make it more human, you know, telling my story. I have a passion for fixing problems. I have a passion for people. That's why I'm here. I want I hope that message picks up. You know, whatever happens with this, I hope somebody steals it, you know, and we kind of, because I can't just sit back.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I know exactly what you mean. And to your point, you know, there's, I had a conversation the other day with a gentleman named Rodney Glassman. Rodney Glassman was running for, I believe it was Attorney General. Mm-hmm. And he is a far right leaning individual. I wouldn't call him far right, but you know, solidly Republican. And of course I have a little bit more of a liberal philosophy when it comes to how to govern a group of people. And you know, we ended up just talking, we ended up meeting just randomly on the street, and we he took a liking to me, and I, you know, he's telling me about his story. I'm telling him about mine. And again, we had a lot in common. So it was really interesting to see, you know, me, this tattooed, you know, younger looking sort of individual who clearly doesn't come from the means that this man comes from. Just having a really
Rodney,
cool
6'5" dark suit, red tie.
That's him. That's him. And so, you know, and I'm 5'8", you know, on a good day, you know, I mean, we're just different people, but you know, he loves his children. You know, I love my sons. We've talked about that, schools, you know, things like this. And it wasn't even a political conversation. It was a human conversation. You would have never, he didn't lead with his politics, and nor did I. We just were two people that met. I was familiar with him. And then as it turned out, he had heard of me from being on the radio for a long time. He's like, oh, I'm familiar. And, you know, so I'm glad you made that point. So let's do this. I'll be honest. I'm newer to the political arena.
Me too.
In brief, well, you may know the answer to this better than I do. In brief, let's describe what a city council person does.
So the city council is responsible for your police, your fire, zoning. Okay, and we'll talk about that because it's an important topic. It's picking up your trash. It's potholes. You know, it's all these little things we usually take for granted every day. But they can have an impact and all their larger scale things, but maybe smaller, like environment, et cetera, maybe water, you can do some things. But you're really police, fire, zoning is, and from what I've seen, is really the core of this, and the potholes and the trash pickup, you know? But you try to kind of influence as much as you can in areas that maybe are more state, federal.
Okay, understood. So you mentioned zoning, and it seemed like you wanted to get into that. Let's do it right now while we're here.
We, you know, so zoning is a really interesting topic because it's not talked about a lot. Sometimes it is, but there is a, I'm just going to say it, there's an inherent racism in zoning. I mean, there just is.
I know.
So, you know, I mean, but it's not talked about, you know, that didn't come up. I don't think it would ever come up. You know, it's a pretty, it's a tough thing for people to handle, but this is what's been going on. And part of what I've, and I've learned that through this process, you know, what's been really interesting is that people that are in the development space sometimes, you know, a lot of times, but they know that that's part of the problem. Like they can't get projects done because of these frameworks that were set up a long time ago. And they want to, sell housing. They want to make it affordable. You know, that's good business.
Sure.
But
you know, something that I realized is that a lot of people that end up benefiting from, let's call it a racist framework that has its roots in a racist past that historically was discriminatory or whatever. Pick your poison for this one. A lot of the people that benefit from it or further it do so because they are unaware of the history, the legacy. They are unaware of the profound implications on people that don't look like them. They lack the frame of reference, the personal experience, or access to conversations to even inform.
Always wealthy, never be anything about wealthy.
But watch this. So on this show, of course, we reckon those folks, our brothers and sisters, the same as anyone else. We recognize that they just lack the perspective, but they often have the power. And what we've learned in our travels here is that white supremacist institutions, visible or invisible, push back against change. This is how they were designed to, you know, and then it's just human nature. I don't want to blame any person. on an individual level. It's human nature. Yeah. I'd imagine any group of human beings that were
sometimes what you learned, sometimes what you went through, sometimes an experience you had that impacted and hasn't given you an opportunity to rethink that.
Exactly. Situation. And then, you know, it's really easy for folks to look at it and say, well, these folks lack empathy. I'll be honest. I've thought that at different points in my life too. Mm-hmm. And I think in my clearer moments, or my moments of clarity, I should say, I have realize that, you know, these folks aren't inherently bad. They're doing what human beings would do. It's kind of like absolute power mm-hmm. corrupts absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they have to be given the breadth to change and the latitude to, you know, evolve.
Yeah, otherwise it's just a war. It's just a war.
So I wanted to make sure that I said that before we got past it. I realized that. But regardless of what the outcomes are, you know, this is what our charge is for anyone who has any power and lacks perspective.
Love's a powerful thing, man.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And I think I'm one of those people.
It's a lot easier to be angry. I've been there. It never really did me much good. Cleaned things up more than I did anything, you know?
Sure,
but love kind of makes things a little easier sometimes.
Yeah,
exactly,
man. So, how about this?
Yeah.
Obviously, I need to ask you this question, but let's make sure that our folks outside of Arizona get some perspective as well.
Please.
Specifically, what would you bring to your role as city councilman in Phoenix?
Yeah.
And what do you see as perhaps issues that affect the country as a whole that could be addressed on, let's say, that level?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I'll start with me kind of where my difference is. I think we're heading into a pretty heavy economic storm.
Okay.
I'm a wartime consigliere. I am someone that solves big problems when S hits the fan.
Okay.
I mean, this is what I do. I do it through diligence. I just don't give up until the problem's solved. I love solving problems. This is my difference. And I'm not doing this because I want to be a career politician. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what my future is. I just know I'm good at solving problems and I won't give up. I mean, part of that is a fear. I fear that a little bit because I'm wondering what's coming for me. If I get this opportunity, I'm going to be changing things.
Yeah.
Maybe drastically.
Sure.
You know, what does that mean? How are they, you know, it's not going to be easy to do that in a place where it's not used to changing. Right. Yeah. But I think for me, that's really my biggest asset is being able to get into these problems. And it's funny when you see a big problem, what people think is causing it is usually wrong.
Yeah.
When you get into the facts, right? Okay. If you really spend the time, you can find out what's really causing it and you can come back and actually address the problem. And we can talk about some problems. I don't want to get too far off, but maybe homeless or police and talk about how those are,
How about this?
Police is national. That's something we could talk about too.
Yeah, of course. Yep. Do you know we were going to talk about that? So let's take a moment. Let's talk about, let's say, homelessness. You know, this is something that it affects us here in Phoenix. I mean, you know, California has a problem with it. And then, of course, housing prices around the country have gone way up and home prices haven't kept up with wages. Of course, graduation. The cost that it takes to go to school and graduate means folks are saddled with debt. Yep. And there's just kind of this whole backwards thing where if you look back, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, it wasn't that way. Folks could really get out there and make something of themselves. And so, let's talk about, you said homelessness.
So that one's really close to me. Again, that's why I like to talk about my background because then it kind of connects the dots emotionally tied to these problems. But so a homeless problem in Phoenix really 4 or 5 years ago wasn't really that noticeable. You know, you always had a little bit of it. It has changed dramatically, All right. All through the city. And I can't speak for other cities, but I'm sure they're experiencing some of that same thing as well. LA's always had it. San Francisco, we always knew there. Those have gotten worse. We didn't really have it. Now we got a problem. Mm-hmm. The main problem with the homeless and how we're not really addressing it appropriately is one, we're not owning the problem. So owning the problem is knowing how many homeless you have in your city, having accurate information, data about how many homeless you have.
Sure.
Right. The city isn't taking leadership role to say, okay, we're going to set up stations around the city, you know, offer food, water, whatever it may be. So we continually kind of collect this data, know how many people we have. If we don't know how many people we have, how do we solve the problem?
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So then once you have the data, you break it down really into three buckets that you're dealing with in the homeless situation, dealing with severely mentally ill,
mm-hmm.
which is actually, from all the experts I talk to, is a bulk of the problem. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that's the bulk of the problem is that 90% of our mental and psychiatric hospitals have been closed in the last 40 or 50 years. Mm-hmm. We pushed them all on the street. Okay, this was a Reagan era policy, and that essentially is carried on. The next thing we're dealing with is addiction. People don't understand always addiction, man. Sometimes these kids are coming off of good homes. They bounce around couches, they stole, and then they ended up on the street. Now they're near their dealer, right? It's not always lower income. These kids are coming from all over the place, but you've got addiction. And then you have people that have fallen on hard times. Now, those are three buckets. Once I have an accurate count of what we're dealing with, I can then put a solution in place, sure. Right? I can expand psychiatric hospitals, addiction facilities. I was at a woman's recovery facility a couple weeks ago, and there was a woman there that 30 years she was on and off the street. I mean, drugs. She came from a good home, just things didn't work, you know, just spiraled out of control, mm-hmm. on the streets, heroin, you name it. 2 years in this facility, she has a home, she has a job. We saved a life. Mm-hmm. And right now we're spending money. This city, I mean, it's been documented 40 or 50,000 per homeless. I'm hearing experts saying 80,000 per homeless. And that's because police, fire response, hospitals, all this stuff adds up. Man, that's
all the services,
$2,000 every time somebody shows up. Yeah. You know, somebody said $20,000, I think, when we were speaking, and that's just way off, right? Yeah. So we're spending money. Let's put it towards a solution that works, right? And then, so the third bucket is that housing. We've got to get building housing. We're just not doing it, right? Sure. It's too slow. It's too political. And those people, those people's problems are a little easier to solve, you know, but we need those three buckets. We then need to provide the right solutions to then solve it. And we can make a real dent. I'm not saying wipe it out completely, but man, we can hit it. Impact. You know, money's being spent.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you this, low cost housing obviously is something that a lot of folks don't want to touch it, but
I want to talk about
there's
that.
There is an approach to it. And on this show, we famously, Q and I, my co-host and I, we spent 10 years on the streets of Phoenix, actually feeding the homeless through our nonprofit called the Change Society. And we fed folks out of Monarch Theater.
Yeah.
And we partnered with CAS and the Midwest Food Bank and so forth. So this is obviously something that we know very well, and just glad that you have a plan for that. So we will definitely talk about that more on the second half of the show.
And now, proper propaganda. Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists with journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
If you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I am your host, Ramses Ja. Big shout out to my man, Q Ward, who has taken the week off, but shall return in short order to give you more of his thoughts and his perspective on all the things that you know and love for him to talk about, I'm sure. Anyway, this week we have a very special guest with us, Harry Curtin, who I met at a panel for, you know, folks running for city council. He's the person that I thought I would lend my endorsement to, and I invited him up on the show, and he's here with us to discuss, you know, the role of local government, certain policies that he feels could be beneficial, and just, you know, what the future may hold for us. So we're going to talk more with him. And we're also going to discuss Benjamin Banneker for our Way Black History Fact. And he's a very interesting person that shows that we were not just slaves and conquered tribes brought over to this country, but great thinkers and contributors to the foundation of this great nation of ours. But first and foremost, let's discuss Baba, how to become a better ally. Today's Baba is sponsored by Major Threads, where high fashion meets timeless menswear. Visit majorthreads.com for more information. The passage I'm reading comes from scotusblog.com, and I'm going to need you to pay a little bit of attention because the Baba comes in the end. All right. In February, a divided Supreme Court temporarily blocked a ruling by a three-judge district court in Alabama, which had agreed the state's new congressional map likely violates the Voting Rights Act. After nearly 2 hours of oral argument on Tuesday, the justices appeared inclined to permanently set aside the district court's ruling, even if it wasn't clear on exactly what theory they would do so. But even a narrower ruling than the broad pronouncement the state seeks would, the plaintiffs contend, make it much more difficult to challenge redistricting plans on the grounds that they weaken the collective voting power of Black people. So yeah, this is something we got to pay attention to. The law at the center of this case is Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which bars election practices that result in the denial or abridgment of the right to vote based on race. Voters and other groups have challenged Alabama's 2021 redistricting map for its 7 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives, arguing that the map violates Section 2 by diluting the votes of the state's Black residents, who make up 27% of the state's population. The state, the challenger said, illegally packed many Black voters into one district as part of Alabama, known as the Black Belt. At the time, the challengers contend the state dispersed Black voters in the rest of the Black Belt into several other districts where they are only a minority, when it should have created an additional majority Black district. A 3-judge court that included 2 judges appointed by President Donald Trump ruled that the map likely violates Section 2, but in February, the Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-4, put that decision on hold, allowing Alabama to use the map in the 2022 elections and set the case for argument in the 2022-23 term. If you want to help push back against this, please visit naacp.org/donate. We need our vote. We need our voice. Once again, naacp.org/donate. All right. Now, back to today's guest, Mr. Harry Curtin.
All right.
All right. We talked about local government. We talked about homelessness a bit.
Yep.
Let's get to the big
to
one.
The meat.
Let's get to the meat. All right. What are your thoughts on the current state of policing?
Yeah. So this is something at a city council level, you have a lot of input and mm-hmm. a lot of you can make some real good happen in this area for sure. All right. So the police, for me, I talked a little bit in the beginning about, you know, my story and kind of what I went through as a kid. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I wanted to be a police officer. Mm-hmm. You know, they were my heroes. They looked out for me in these, you know, times when they would be showing up to our house to break up a dispute between my parents. I mean, I sometimes knew their names better than I knew my teachers. Mm. Little kids don't want to be police officers anymore. Mm. And probably for good reason. You know, we haven't evolved that department the way we should. We haven't supported the officers the way we should. But I think what we're missing is how we policed in the past is not what's going to work in the future, today and in the future. And we've been unfair to them, and we've been unfair to the public. And there's a lot that can change there to make them more supported, make them want to be a police officer again, allow them to have the career opportunities that they should have, but also get the officers we want to support the problems we have in the city.
Sure.
So, you know, this is a problem I've thought so deeply about. I mean, I think about it all the time. And one of the things that really drove me to run for office, for me, if I just had like a golden opportunity, if I said, hey, I could just wave a wand and get what I want, what I would want is essentially a advanced campus for training for police officers, one that country's never seen before. Something, I mean, I think Star Trek, I mean, advanced, beautiful campus that focuses on social work, mental health, you know, cyber, all these different areas that a police officer now deals with on a daily basis, not always cyber, but a lot of these areas, because I mean, we're expecting an officer to show up and deal with a mental health crisis, a domestic dispute, you know, all these things and solve in one day. And they don't have those skills. You know, yeah. We haven't given them those tools. We're not fair to them. And then we're like, oh yeah, you did a bad job. Well, I wouldn't do good. I mean, how could you possibly do it? What I see is an expanded police force, but a different kind of police force. I'm talking about community policing. And you have a domestic dispute, you have someone that shows up that's highly trained in that area, show up. Maybe you have an officer in the background, you know, the gun, if something goes wrong, but you're essentially diagnosing the problem from 911 as best you can mm-hmm. to bring the right resource. So we're not escalating, we're de-escalating.
Right.
You know, it's just a totally different vision. And you're going to get officers that want to be there again. You're going to get a community that's supported. You're going to have people going out that can actually help with these problems. We're just not.
I love that you have this approach. I want to share something with you, if I may.
Please.
First off, my co-host Q.
Yeah.
He has the same background. When he was younger, he wanted to be a police officer. In fact, when he was old enough, he actually applied.
Really?
So yeah. He's someone that grew up sort of espousing the idea
sure.
of being
there were heroes, Die Hard. We
there
had
you
all
go.
No.
There you yeah, go. Right.
Yeah.
I was kind of meant to be a rock star, so it didn't really.
Yeah, it wasn't in really the cards, man. Yeah.
But
you had too good of hair, I guess.
Yeah. You're very kind. So here's my view.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. We ask police to do too much. The way that we have framed policing via what is known as copaganda, mm-hmm. meaning police are espoused, especially espoused through Hollywood films and, you know, crime stories and true crime, this sort of stuff. And the way that police misconduct is sort of buried, the way that the policing kind of, are you familiar with the Stanford experiments? We won't get into how familiar they are.
Give me back, because I do know this.
The Stanford experiments is basically a prison experiment.
That's right, okay.
Where,
I saw the movie, I don't know how accurate it was.
But it gives you a glimpse into human psychology. Yeah. It's not the most, it's debatable, you know, how the experiment was conducted, but it does serve as, you know, again, we mentioned absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah.
This is a thing. It's a human condition. We're not, you know, pointing anything.
I'm with you.
Racially, it's a human condition, right?
Yeah.
So when it comes to policing, so I've been around the world. I've been very fortunate. I've traveled. I've been all 50 states. I've been, seen a good amount of this planet.
Me too. I've had a good opportunity. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. So I've been in places where police have no guns. Mm-hmm. It's not a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have crime in the way that we do.
Yeah. Jails are different.
Jails are different, of course. Mm-hmm. But I've been in places where police do have guns. Mm-hmm. And this is a country where we do have the right to bear arms. Famously is a gun owner. I famously am not. I do not mm-hmm. believe that my purpose, I was not created by our common creator to take a life. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe a gun is how you defend yourself. That's how you end a life. Yeah. That's the only purpose of that. If I'm defending myself, it's with vest or, you know, hiding or something.
Words. Yeah. Hopefully. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but I that's to execute, not to defend. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I've been places where the police do have guns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have the right to bear arms in these countries as well.
Yeah.
And the police will keep their guns in the trunk of their car. There's a step between where you have no gun.
I'm with you.
And where you have sort of this ready fire aim happening over and over again.
I'm with you.
Absolutely. I know that you are. This is for our listeners, but we're painting a picture here because I'd love your thoughts here. Now,
I think we can get there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So watch this.
Yeah.
What we have right now, I think it appeals to people who want to do good, absolutely. Yeah. But it also appeals to people who maybe themselves have been bullied by parents in their home.
Mm-hmm.
They want respect. They want, you know, they want that gun. Mm-hmm. That gun commands respect. There's no two ways about it, right? Mm-hmm. And if they have a gun and a way to, if you don't respect me, if you don't respect my authority, then they kind of, it's kind of like a rage quit. You know, this is something that we see quite often. I have an example. We will talk about it next week on the show.
Yeah.
Our producer, Maggie B. Nolan, put it together for us. And this is, normally we talk about stories that affect Black and Brown communities,
mm-hmm.
Our Asian American and Pacific Islander brothers and sisters, so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But this will probably be a third or fourth show where we talk about exclusively our Caucasian brothers and sisters. And there was a young man who lost his life at the hands of police. It's on video.
Mm-hmm.
And he was white. He parked his vehicle and he called the police and he said, I'm having a tough time here. I need some help.
Yeah.
And the police came and they did try to talk to him.
Yeah.
And after some time, they wanted to go home, I guess, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He may have had like a pocket and something in the car. I don't remember what it was. You'll get the actual story next week, or you can look this up. They wanted to tase him. When they started tasing him, of course, he's moving erratically, and then one of the officers shot him through the front window. He called them because he was having a problem. He wanted to help, but he didn't want to get out of the car because
of mental health issue.
Yeah. And he's no longer here. So
police officers weren't trained for that.
There you go. So what we have is a system that puts fear kind of squarely in the middle of the narrative for police officers.
Yeah, like that's the tool. You have that's to protect. The only tool they have right now.
Well watch. Watch this.
Yeah.
You're a police officer. You know it's crazy out here. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a gun,
mm-hmm.
so you need to have your gun. If you feel your life is in danger, you need to shoot. You know, blah blah blah. Rather than hey. you realize that this job could be dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, this could be a dangerous job. Our job is to help people, you know, and kind of have a different orientation around it. We have a certain orientation where the officer had to, they feared for his life. It was justified, blah, blah, blah. And we're seeing that people are losing their life needlessly. People that didn't intend to wake up and do anything crazy and end up dead, mm-hmm. end up dead very often. Not to say that police officers shouldn't be able to protect themselves, but yeah. when we go into it with fear, the officers are that afraid. Q doesn't like when I use that word because he often sees these videos as being overt racism or, you know, like, I just don't care about these people's lives mm-hmm. and I'm going to see this through to the end. But mm-hmm. for me, a lot of times I try to give the benefit of the doubt. I call it fear.
Yep.
When the officers are made to be afraid, when fear is sort of where they operate from, and we give them a device, a contraption whose only purpose is to end a life, mm-hmm. then we end up seeing the same stories that we see over and over again. And so mm-hmm. to your point, you know, the state of policing is not necessarily about the individual police officers. It's about police culture. If it's based around fear, if we're giving people guns and their guns is like the first line of defense, if we're militarizing the police, they got these Punisher masks that align with their identity and so forth. They're, it enhances bully culture. It enhances us versus them as opposed to, listen, we are in the same community. I have friends right now who are police officers. I've shouted them out on this show before. And a lot of you listening, I know well, a lot of my listeners, they are going to hear that and be like, oh my God. But I do. I'll be honest. Hey, I do have friends.
They're people, man.
Yeah,
I mean, look, until we've given them the tools and the investment and given them tools that they can actually address these problems correctly.
Sure.
I think we're... Man, I mean, think about a day in the life of a police officer in terms mm-hmm. of what they make. You know, they're struggling to raise their family. Mm-hmm. And then they're going out, they're laying their life on the line. They have to solve all these city problems mm-hmm. in a day. Often, I mean, look, man, I know there's the bad apple thing. You know, I get it. But Jesus, how many times do you make a mistake in a week?
And what are the implications of a very small scale?
We got none. Very big, They've got none. They've got no room, you know.
Understood. And
I want to give them the right tools. I want to invest. I want to create that. And then I can kind of come in with a stick. You know, I want to do the right thing. I don't think we're doing the right thing. You know, nobody wants to be a cop. So we're going to be in trouble here.
And another thing. So there's a lot of people that feel like the change is going to happen overnight. And I realize that things need to evolve and they probably are going to evolve very slowly.
Yeah.
As is often the case with things central to the Black plight in this country.
Yeah.
Again, there are a lot of institutions that are resistant to change mm-hmm. because that's the way we've always done it, right?
Yeah.
And a shift in the narrative, a shift in the identity, and the shift in, we'll call it politics.
This will be a tough fight.
Right. There's
people that are used to it being this way. There's officers that want it, but won't be able to speak up either.
Sure.
There's going to be all that.
Sure. All of it. And I think to your point, I someone who's willing to say, listen, what we have is not working. What we've done in the past is not working. Throwing more money at the problem without creating new
solutions,
guidelines, solutions, rules, a plan, it does nothing for no one. Yeah. And so this is kind of what really stood out to me when you were speaking. Obviously, I could go on and on about the way policing is done. Again, the human beings.
Yeah.
I don't take issue with the human beings, but the institution, the way that it is executed throughout society.
Well, the same way we have for 100 years.
I mean, right. Exactly. Well said.
It's changed,
it overwhelmingly
it's not
benefits,
the Wild West anymore. Man.
Right. It overwhelmingly benefits a certain group of people. They don't see the problems. They don't see the flaws. The police never interact with them other than wave and say hi. And then there's other groups of people where they are overly policed and therefore overly incarcerated. Not that they do more crimes.
I'm worried about that too, but I'm worried about the police officers and what they're going through.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
as you should
be. I feel for them.
As you should be. But, you know, we have to bear in mind the nature of the job mm-hmm. and the purpose of the job is to serve the community, or at least in theory. The Supreme Court decided that police officers do not have to in fact serve and protect, but in theory this is what they do. And so everyone deserves a voice in terms of how their communities are policed. And because oftentimes it's Black and brown mothers that are grieving the loss, the permanent loss of their children, or families ripped apart and beaten or whatever, things that don't make the news, everyone deserves to have a seat at the table. And I think a person who has a degree of empathy and focuses on the human experience of this all deserves to be elected, which is why I will be voting for you.
You're in my district.
Yes, sir. So let's move on.
Can I tell one story?
Please.
Yeah. I'm a part of a group called the 100 Club. It supports fallen officers, first responders, mm-hmm. if they get hurt. Mm-hmm. So I went out, there was a big story here about a year ago where officers were protecting a baby. Somebody was using a baby basically to dodge the bullets. Oof. Five officers went out, they all got shot. Mm. A woman really went in there, dug in, got shot the worst. I went out there, part of the 100 Club, to kind of give them checks just to help them out. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what else to say to them, but I wish it was me. I mean, these are kind, nice people giving their lives. Mm-hmm. What am I doing? You know? And I think this story is complex, you know? And
I'm glad you said that. It is important to say that, and this is why I keep saying that these are people who are part of an institution that there are disproportionate outcomes and effects on communities. The people who are brave, we've covered stories of officers being very brave, charging into a firefight to help protect Black and brown people. Man. We've told those stories on this show. Yeah. And we've also had to talk about Uvalde, and everything in between. And so something that's a bit more consistent that acknowledges the fact that we're dealing with human beings on both sides.
It's
of
love
that point.
Still, man. Stick with love.
Still, there you go. Excellent. So well said, sir. All right. So I want to get this one in. Because this is something that we've touched on a lot on this show.
Yeah.
You mentioned that your success in business and helping people, $1 billion, you know, operations.
Yeah, problems.
And so
forth.
Yeah. So big business is responsible for a lot of what is now being deemed as environmental racism. This is something again that we discussed on this show. For those of you listening who may not be familiar with environmental racism, check out anything on YouTube. John Oliver has a great segment. It's about 20 minutes long. If you don't have 20 minutes, I'm sure there's Vice, there's, you know, other reputable sources, but environmental racism, please look it up. Again, big business is responsible for a lot of what is now being deemed as environmental racism. Mm-hmm. How can, or how should we address this?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a, and you know, we talked just for a second before, it's not a subject I feel I've got clocked, you know, I just don't. And,
that's okay.
And I think you bringing it up, what it pushes me to do is really dig in, you know, what in the city, where are those situations maybe happening? Mm-hmm. That's what I want to know.
I can give you a response.
Yeah,
so watch this.
Tell me, talk to me.
So my Hispanic brothers and sisters are central, what's the word? Concentrated is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
In certain pockets of this city that we live in.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And what we have seen, I've seen a report on this, is that, you know, in Arizona, we have a very specific, unique issue in that it gets very hot here.
Yeah.
If you look in places like, you know, Paradise Valley, which is very affluent, Scottsdale, mm-hmm. Arizona, which again is very affluent, things like this. In those neighborhoods where there's a larger concentration of our Caucasian brothers and sisters, you'll notice that the temperature itself is about, I believe cooler. It's 2 to 8 degrees cooler on average.
Not as much blacktop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And what the city doesn't realize is that it affects health, the health of the individuals of mm-hmm. our Hispanic brothers and sisters. It affects mobility.
Yeah.
It affects housing prices. It affects, you know, so forth and so on. And so when the city comes up with funds to put in parks, green belts, things like this, and they continue to go into neighborhoods that beautify parts of the city that are not really the hardest hit by the sun because they're older neighborhoods, because they're underdeveloped, because they're poor and populated by Hispanic folks. What we all miss out on is an opportunity to bring a little bit of comfort.
Wouldn't that be interesting if we invest there?
That's the point. So this is an example.
How does that change a city?
This is an example.
You're getting to the root.
Thank you. And this is an example, one example of environmental racism. Of course, it's often associated with big business pollution, things like this, businesses in Black and brown neighborhoods, dumping, polluting the air, so forth. It creates health disparities in healthcare. It contributes to early mortality, obesity, all kinds of stuff.
And Arizona's, you know, we're in the desert. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of, if you look at our landscape, we try to be somewhere else sometimes, and we have things that maybe shouldn't be here. We're wasting water, but also we're just not being coherent to the environment that we live in.
Sure,
be able to provide. Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. So what I want to do is I want to take a minute and I want you to, okay, I'm a voter.
Yeah.
Why would I vote for you?
This is always
take question. 1 minute. One minute. Why would I vote for you? And then I need your website, social media, all that.
Yeah,
stuff,
so. Yeah. This is I'm not a pitch man.
It's okay.
I'm a storyteller.
But I'll watch the clock. You take your time.
I'm here to help. You know, I've spent a career in my last 20 years to solve these major problems, big complicated problems. I'm the last guy you call, and I just want to put those skills to work. I'm not a career politician. I believe you get in, you get out. Mm-hmm. You know, you. This is a public service. I am servicing the community, not about servicing myself and my career.
Sure.
This is what it's about. And I truly believe in this city. I think we can be a leader in this nation. I wouldn't be doing it otherwise. You know, if I didn't think we could lead in police, if I didn't think we could lead in homeless, I wouldn't be doing this. I think there's an opportunity here, and that's why I'm doing it.
Wonderful. And, you know, there's the person who you are hopefully replacing, you know, I reached out to him a few times, yeah. And he actually responded to me. This was via Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was so dug in, mm-hmm. on one side that, and so deaf to any complaints or anything like that, that it made it very difficult. And one thing that I want to applaud, sir, is that you seem like a person who's willing to listen to the humans. And my hope is that you will go far. Of course, we're lending our platform to you today. Please find out more about Harry Curtin at harrycurtin.com.
Yep.
And yep. Your social media, please.
Yeah. So just Harry Curtin, very easy to search. So it's HARRYCURTIN. You know, at the harrycurtin.com, we're taking donations. Campaigns are expensive. Anything you can do, we certainly appreciate. But just appreciate your support, jumping on board, Twitter, et cetera. We'd love to have you.
Absolutely. And now it's time for the Way Black History Fact. This week's Way Black History Fact is sponsored by Hip Hop Weekly Magazine. All the latest in hip hop culture is available at hiphopweekly.com. Today's story comes from biography.com, and we will be discussing Benjamin Banneker. So I will read. Benjamin Banneker was a largely self-educated mathematician, astronomer, compiler of almanacs, and writer. A free black man who owned a farm near Baltimore, Benjamin Banneker was largely self-educated in astronomy and mathematics. He was later called upon to assist in the surveying of territory for the construction of the nation's capital. He also became an active writer of almanacs and exchanged letters with Thomas Jefferson, politely challenging him to do what he could to ensure racial equality. Born November 9th, 1731, in Elliott's Mills, Maryland, Banneker was the son of an ex-slave named Robert and his wife, Mary Banneke. Mary was the daughter of an English woman named Molly Welsh, a former indentured servant, and her husband, Banneke, an ex-slave whom she freed and who asserted that he came from tribal royalty in West Africa. Because both of his parents were free, Benjamin escaped the wrath of slavery as well. He was taught to read by his maternal grandmother and for a very short time attended a small Quaker school. Banneker was primarily self-educated. His early accomplishments included constructing an irrigation system for the family farm and a wooden clock that was reputed to keep accurate time and ran for more than 50 years until his death. In addition, Banneker taught himself astronomy and accurately forecasted lunar and solar eclipses. After his father's passing, he ran his own farm for years, cultivating a business selling tobacco via crops. Banneker's talents and intelligence eventually came to the attention of the Elliott family, entrepreneurs who made a name and fortune by building a series of grist mills in the Baltimore area in the 1770s. George Eliot had a large personal library and loaned Banneker numerous books on astronomy and other fields. In 1791, Andrew Eliot, George's cousin, hired Banneker to assist in surveying territory for the nation's capital city. He worked in the observatory tent using a zenith sector to record the movement of the stars. However, due to a sudden illness, Banneker was only able to work for Eliot for about 3 months. For those of you that know, like, kind of the mysteries and, you know, the secrets of DC, there's a much deeper story here about Benjamin Banneker and how the buildings are aligned in certain positions and so forth, how the streets are laid out, etc. Anyway, I'll continue. Banneker's true acclaim, however, came from his almanacs, which he published for six consecutive years during the later years of his life. Between 1792 and 1797, these hard books included his own astronomical calculations, as well as opinion pieces, literature, and medical and tidal information, with the latter particularly useful to fishermen. Outside of his almanacs, Banneker also published information on bees and calculated the cycle of the 17-year locust. Banneker's accomplishments extended into other realms as well, including civil rights. In 1791, Jefferson was Secretary of State, and Banneker considered the respected Virginian, though a slaveholder, to be open to view African Americans as more than just slaves. Thus, he wrote Jefferson a letter hoping he would, quote, readily embrace every opportunity to eradicate that train of absurd and false ideas and opinions which so generally prevail with respect to us, unquote. To further support his point, Banneker included a handwritten manuscript of an almanac for 1792 containing his astronomical calculations. In his letter, Banneker acknowledged he was, quote, of the African race, unquote, and a free man. He recognized that he was taking a liberty writing to Jefferson, which would be unacceptable considering the almost general prejudice and prepossession which is so prevalent in the world against those of my complexion. This is what he said. Banneker then respectfully chided Jefferson and other patriots for their hypocrisy, enslaving people like him while fighting the British for their own independence. On October 9th, 1806, after his usual morning walk, Banneker died in his sleep, just a month short of his 75th birthday. In accordance with his wishes, all the items that had been on loan from his neighbor, George Eliot, were returned by Banneker's nephew. Also included was Banneker's astronomical journal, providing future historians one of the few records of his life known to exist. And that is a gentleman that I want you to know about, because sometimes the way Black History Fact tells you about injustices, sometimes the way Black History Fact tells you, gives you a historical context of the current standing of Black people, brown people, Asian people, we discuss legislation, we discuss institutions and so forth. But every so often we get to tell cool stories like this one, where we are not just painted as slaves or as people who just simply fought against slavery or just fought against oppression, because on a show like this, we have to highlight those things, but we're rather more than just that as a people. Our stories go much deeper, and obviously illustrated by the numerous things that Benjamin Banneker contributed to this country. And of course, his influence on DC and the construction of our nation's capital and the layout and so forth of our nation's capital, which shows that our great minds do rather more than just try to free ourselves. And if Q were here, you know, he would know a little bit, he would have a little bit more to say there, because oftentimes the stories that we have to tell on the stories, really the stories that we've inherited as, you know, Black folks in 2022, they're oftentimes stories of overcoming a struggle. And so it was meaningful today. Maggie, of course, our producer, Maggie B. Noen, wanted to share this story at some point. And today just kind of felt a little bit more meaningful. And again, I implore you to look up DC, look up the brilliance that went into it. You know, I shared on the show before that I was in Egypt for my 40th birthday, and I was made aware of how the stars were incorporated into, you know, their designs and the pyramids and the layout of the temples and so forth, so that they could capture the light, the sun's rotation, and it could hit certain facets and certain smooth surfaces and reflect and light a room up. And you'll see the same type of brilliance in engineering inherent in the designs of our nation's capital. And there was a Black man who was at the table helping design that. And so, again, very important to tell these stories, to tell them accurately, and make sure that we tell our whole story, not just the parts of it that pull at the heartstrings or you know, paint us as one type of people, because we, like other people, are very diverse and have a lot to offer. And so, yeah, shout out to Benjamin Banneker. We accept your legacy, sir, and we salute you today. But that's going to do it for us here on Civic Cypher. So once again, I am your host, Ramses Ja. Big shout out to my man, Q Ward. Again, he will be back next week. The show is produced by our show producer, Ms. Maggie, a.k.a. Maggie B. Nolan. And again, I want to thank our guest, Harry Curtin. Once again, do me a favor, plug your website and your social media so we can get folks tapped in.
HarryCurtin.com, HarryCurtin.com, and then Harry Curtin on social media. I'm one of the only Harry Curtins. So I'm easy
to
find.
Sure. Yeah. Awesome. I love it. Yeah, I love it. I'm lending you my support, and I hope a good majority of our listeners do the same, especially those that can. And everyone else who's beyond the scope of District 6 follows your career in politics or whatever it is. You seem to be a good man, and I wish you well on your journey. And that's going to do it for us once again. So hit the website, civiccypher.com. Download this and any previous episodes. You can also make a donation to Civic Cypher. We're at Civic Cypher on all social media platforms and all donating platforms. And I think that's about it. So until next week, y'all. Peace.
You like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander / beat expander. Here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show. Get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines, wake up, refuse, and resist. Like this.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday nights,
midnight
to 3 a.m.